everybody. Welcome again to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We're here to talk about true crime. Before we do that, I would like to talk about football for just a moment, if that's okay. My Steelers miraculously made the playoffs last night, and we're recording this on Monday night. The national championship game is about to take place over at Easy Street right now. You won't hear this in time to come and join us, but I'm very excited to finish recording tonight, walk right across the parking lot. We're here in the new Shane Givens Law Office, which is adjacent to Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall in Center. I'm very excited. Hello, guys.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, Scott.
My name is Scott Wright, and I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Kelly Turner. I'm not a doctor.
I'm Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
So we are here tonight to do the second of a two-part episode about the Beatrice Six. If you are tuning in for the first time tonight, you want to stop right now, go back and listen to Season 2, Episode 1.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And get caught up on what we're talking about, because this is a very interesting case. Kelly is in the big chair on this one for the second week in a row, so we're going to sit back and let you take it away and finish the story that you started last week.
So I just want to give everybody the talking points from last week. So we had a very lovely grandmother and great-grandmother and mother who was raped and murdered in Beatrice, Nebraska on February the 6th, 1985. Mm-hmm. And we had several persons of interest, 62 to be exact. We mentioned a few. We mentioned Bert. Was it Bruce Allen Smith?
Bruce Allen Smith was the first person that we mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And his test results came back and he was found to be type B blood, which is what we were looking for. Mm-hmm. But he is, according to the test results, he was a secretor, and our perpetrator is a non-secretor.
Right, and he seemed suspicious at the beginning because he was in the area at a weird time of day on a very cold morning. He had been placed there, and it seemed like he was a suspicious character, but his blood was wrong, so he could not have been the perpetrator of this rape.
So to speak. And so we enter in new law enforcement, the sheriff's office, we mentioned Burdett. What was Burdett's last name?
Searcy,
that's right.
Bert for
We're
short.
Yeah, Bert. Bert Searcy comes into play and somehow finagles five people to confess to this crime. They are going to go on and incriminate a sixth person. And they're known as the Beatrice Six. And that's where we are here. We're in part two. We have a, in between those two things, in between the Beatrice City Police, Beatrice Police Department,
right,
testing the blood of all the 62 persons of interest, we get the FBI involved. So if you go back to Season 2, Episode 1 of the Beatrice Six, you can listen to the very detailed FBI profile that I read directly from the profiler himself's book. That's very interesting as well, because he says there is one perpetrator, and there's no doubt in his mind that it's one perpetrator. So to fast forward and have six people in custody is quite the stretch. So I'm going to turn it over to Katie from here to kind of talk about how in the heck did we get from this one perpetrator to now we have six perpetrators. And the case has been taken over by the sheriff's department and Bert Searcy.
Right.
Right. I'm going to kind of go into detail about each individual member of the Beatrice Six and how they came into the crime and into their confessions and into custody, I guess. So like Kelly said, we've got Bert Searcy, who was leading the investigation. And then we have a man named Wayne Price, who is a deputy, but he's also a psychologist. He is, for lack of a better term, a police psychologist. And he interviews all six of these suspects as well. He tells them, for each one that tells him that they can't remember what happened, he tells them that memories of the murder would probably come back in dreams or deep thought, but they may take a while. he believes in the phrase memory repression, which is reflecting a popular movement among psychologists at the time. The same theory led to a numerous amount of wrongful convictions nationwide during this time. You may be familiar with this term if you've ever looked into anything with the satanic panic. Psychologists during that time would lead children to believe they were victims of sexual abuse when they really couldn't remember anything. If you've ever done any research or listened to any podcast,
that sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You probably looked into satanic panic when we did the Corpsewood Manor.
Yes, exactly. That. Thank you for reminding me. I was sitting here spinning, trying to remember when it was, and that's exactly when it was. It was the Corpsewood Manor case from 82 that we did over in Chattooga County.
And I just want to say, Dr. Price, I'm using that term very sarcastically. Mm-hmm. Dr. Price, he did have a PhD in psychology, and but he was also a reserve deputy sheriff. As this tends to happen in smaller towns, you have people who may be a reserve deputy and have another type of day job. So he enters into these interviews with each of these people. He's claiming that from the psychologist standpoint, however, he is a deputy in full deputy garb interviewing these people. And two of the Beatrice Six he had seen previously at his practice. One, Joanne Taylor, when for a custody battle. And he had also, what was the other lady that he had seen previously?
Debbie Sheldon,
who, right. So this is not, I don't know the laws in 1985 about this, but I will say this has never, nor will it ever be ethical.
Yes, I was about to say, regardless of legality, it can't be ethical.
The ethics of this, quote, doctor are sickening to me.
Yeah. Sickening. So, I mean, just to summarize briefly, so he has sat in a room with these people before and established a profile or talked to them long enough to know what kind of person they are. So 1 year or 2 years later, he's in a different capacity as a deputy sheriff now, trying to get them to admit to being in a room when a murder took place.
Yes.
And he has all of these insights about their psyche that he allegedly was able to use in conjunction with Bert Searcy's interview tactics.
Yes.
To convince these people to make confessions that they later wished that they had not, perhaps.
And he's using a theory that has been debunked time and time again as far as the dreams. If you think about your dreams, holy crap, if my dreams were memories that I had repressed that were coming back to me, at some point in time, I have defied all laws of space and time.
Yeah,
and
I can fly.
Gravity.
By that logic, and, yeah, I am Superman.
Everything.
Right.
Right, correct. So this has been widely debunked. So Katie, I'm sorry, I'll let you get back to your story.
I was going to say, remember, this case was cold for 4 years. They couldn't find a culprit. They arrested dozens of people and tested them and sent them on their way because they had this blood type that they were looking for that no one had. It was a very rare blood type. So by 1989, they had decided that they were looking for people who were sexually unconventional and or collected porn. Like that was one of their profilings on suspects. So enter Joanne Taylor. This stemmed from, at the time, there was a 17-year-old informant that told authorities that Joanne had confessed to her about the crime. Nothing about this confession added up to the actual crime, but they brought her in anyway. Police brought her in to interview, and it wasn't long before she was convinced that she was guilty of the murder. According to transcripts and federal court records, Joanne Taylor told detectives that she was, quote unquote, was told that she was at Wilson's apartment by the police who brought her to jail. She said they had worked on bringing back little bits of her memory.
Yeah.
She also said in her interview that she said, I was told that I was there. Mm-hmm. And Bert Searcy says something along the lines of, can you talk about that? Or what do you mean you were told you were there? And she said, the officers who arrested me told me they had evidence that I was there.
Yeah. I mean, according to the book that I read about this case, Joanne Taylor had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder.
Yes. And she also had several other issues. She was quite delusional at times.
Yeah. And it seems like, and I don't know, Katie may address this. It just seems like the people who lived and worked in Beatrice would have known that about this woman. And there wouldn't have been a lot of heed taken to this very detailed and very wrong confession that she gave. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow someone was able to wad this ball of Play-Doh into something that looked like a pair of handcuffs.
Well, that would be Bert Searcy.
Yes.
And Dr. whoever.
Wayne Price.
Dr. Price.
Yeah.
Sorry, well, Katie.
When she was told she couldn't remember anything accurate about Wilson's apartment, what Wilson was wearing, or like she said, I can't remember why I would have went inside. Mm-hmm. Police told her, don't worry. Let us try and help you refresh your memory.
She also originally said that they went to a light-colored house.
Yeah, that was her first memory.
That was her first memory. And
in a recorded videotaped interview with Bert Searcy.
Yes, and Helen Wilson lived in a tall red brick building.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So she first said they were in a light-colored house, and then she said that they were there. She was there with Joseph White. Mm-hmm. And that Joseph was there to do some yard work.
On February the 6th, 1985, the coldest day of the year in Beatrice, Nebraska.
That night.
It was 7 below 0.
Yeah. But again, Helen Wilson, our victim, does not have a yard. She lives in a red brick apartment building.
Yep.
So that's what Joanne first says when she's interviewed.
And then somehow through conversation, she mentions to the police that, well, I do always block bad things out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, they were like, well, I guess this is another bad thing that you've just blocked from your memory.
She also said that that she had been using drugs that night and that the walls were melting.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was delusional on multiple levels.
Yes.
And yet somehow.
And was an active substance user.
Yeah.
But she ultimately confesses that she suffocated Helen Wilson with a pillow while a man named Joseph White raped her.
Now, Joseph White is our tie to Alabama. Mm-hmm. I know we said we were going to go outside of the South doing cases, and ultimately this is a Nebraska case, but Joseph White is our Alabama tie. He's from Coleman.
Yes and no. We've gone outside of those state lines, but we have this one little connection still. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
So let's talk about Joseph White. He had been a nude model and a pornography filmmaker. He met Joanne Taylor in California in the early 80s, and they came back to Beatrice, where Joanne was from, and they continued making these porn videos from time to time. Let it be known that Joanne Taylor did not have the correct blood type that was found in the apartment, and neither did Joseph White.
Right, yeah. That is correct. Also, Joseph White, growing up, was a Boy Scout. He also went into the military and served his time and was honorably discharged. And then went out to Hollywood and, you know, made some porn films.
And if you remember back, that was part of the profile that the county police department was looking for, was people who had things to do with porn or...
When they decided to refocus on when Searcy took over for the sheriff's department, and they decided, am I saying this right? When Searcy got hired on at the sheriff's department, he decides he's going to reopen this case, and that's his angle to take to try and solve it, because the previous angle didn't work. They didn't pay any attention to the FBI profile. No. They did their own thing.
White was adamant that he did not commit this murder, that he was not there. He did not do this. He could not be talked into remembering that he did it.
Correct. He's the only one of the Beatrice Six that doesn't confess.
Who steadfastly maintained his innocence.
Mm-hmm. And when neither of them had the correct blood type and White would not confess, police decided there must be more suspects involved. It must not have been just the two of them. Like I said, there was no other evidence to place White there except his friend's false memories and... spoiler alert, an upcoming dream that he was
there. Ah, I think I saw that one coming based on, yeah.
Detectives threatened to test his blood, hair, and semen to prove his guilt, and he said, please.
Go for
it. Test it all.
He freely offered it. Yes. Yeah.
He told his mother, when they came to Alabama and picked him up and hauled him away in handcuffs in front of his mother, he said, Mom, don't worry. This is a mistake. I'll be back in a couple of weeks when we get this straightened out.
He files motions for a DNA test to be done, and the court denies these motions. And during this time, Joanne Taylor mentions that there was another boy at the crime scene with the two of them. So enter Thomas Winslow. When she mentions that there's another boy in the crime scene, they bring out a photo lineup of people, and she picks out Thomas Winslow out of this photo lineup. He's currently incarcerated at the time, and he just so happened to be a high school friend of Joanne Taylor's. So she picks him out of this lineup. He also does not have the correct blood type that they are looking for, but they arrest him anyway.
So that's 0-3, but 3-3 arrests.
Yes. Well, they don't arrest him. He's already in jail.
He's already incarcerated, yes.
But they can't wait to talk to him because maybe he doesn't want to be in jail anymore, right, Katie? Mm-hmm.
So they let him know, you know, if you talk to us and, you know, we go over what happened here, you know, you'll get out quicker.
Always. Interesting. I can't imagine how many incarcerated individuals perk up and say, oh, I'm very willing to help.
And so he does get out of jail on what he was serving for currently, only to be picked back up for this crime.
Yeah, he had been, he was in jail because he had been involved in a robbery where somebody got bashed over the head with a crowbar. So according to the book that I read, he was going to be in jail for several years for this, for perpetrating this crime, this burglary. And so when he had a chance to admit to being involved in the murder of Helen Wilson, not involved, but to finger other people who had been involved.
Say he was there and he knew what went on that night.
Yeah. And that's just how intelligent Tom Winslow wasn't, because in order to describe these things that happened, he's placing himself at the scene of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to come back to bite him in the ass, as Katie just mentioned.
And enter suspect number 4, Debbie Sheldon. She was targeted because she hung around the group, and they brought her in. And after interviews with police and with Price, the psychologist, he brought the idea that she had repressed the memory of the crime. And so she's like, he convinced her that she'd repressed this memory. And so she confesses. She also brings in our fifth suspect after she has a dream that a man named James Dean was at Wilson's house that night too.
Not that James Dean.
And not the actor James Dean. But I just wanted to say one thing about Debbie Sheldon. In watching some of the interviews with Debbie Sheldon, it does not take you 60 seconds to figure out that she has a learning disability.
She is mentally deficient.
She is, and she is, her IQ is not very high.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to be hateful to her. But it's one of the first things that you notice when you watch the interview. She's very easily manipulated. And I think with the exception of Joseph White, that is one consistency that you see with all of these individuals is I don't believe that any of them I don't believe that any of them, with the exception of Joseph White, has a very high IQ.
It seems like that's pretty, according to what I read somewhere, in order to be able to be manipulated the way that these people were all manipulated, you would have to be very easily persuaded for a variety of reasons, perhaps adolescence, he said, in one case, or maybe low self-esteem, or maybe some sort of learning disability.
And
these are all adult human beings.
They are all adult human beings. I believe they have... Several of them have mental health issues, and I believe most of them have low IQ.
And Debbie did not have the correct blood type either.
So we got to keep going.
So we're 0-4.
0-4.
But we're 4-4 in the big house.
Yes.
Okay.
So James is arrested after Debbie dreamed he was there. After some interviews with Price, the psychologist, he also believes he forgot the violent assault that happened. And he gives his false confession. He also does not have type B blood.
Right.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we're 0-5.
Yeah.
How are we going to get this blood type? We've got to have somebody with this blood type.
Or the whole thing goes off the rails.
Exactly.
Well, enter suspect number 6, Kathy Gonzalez. She falls under suspicion when Debbie Sheldon and James Dean said that they dreamed about her being at the scene.
Now, she lives in the apartment above Helen Wilson, correct? Yes. She lives in the building.
And there was a time when she did.
Does she still live there?
I thought she...
I'm not clear on that. Maybe she still did at the time that she was incarcerated.
But at one point in time,
later,
she was Helen Wilson's neighbor.
When the murder took place, she was the upstairs neighbor. Now, this is 4 years later, so I don't know if she still does. But at the time of the murder, she did.
She was the upstairs neighbor.
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
She tries to hold her ground. She says, I could swear I was just doing laundry that night. Like, I remember that night, and I was doing laundry. And the psychologist, Wayne Price, assures her that she had probably witnessed Wilson's murder and just couldn't remember.
See, I wrote down a note on yesterday afternoon. I was preparing for today, and there was this one thing that I wrote down, and I just wrote down the word alibis with like 4 question marks because there wasn't anything that I had really read anywhere that described to me what any of these people had for an alibi, but Katie has just made me realize that they all probably started out with an alibi.
They did.
And then Dr. Price convinced them that they were misremembering it and that their dream was actually telling them where they had been that night.
Yeah, Dr. Price, quote doctor, would do that. However, there was also a couple of interrogations with Bert Searcy where you have Joanne Taylor and you have Thomas Winslow, and they're not remembering things very well. If you'll recall back to Joanne's interview about the light-colored house and doing the yard work, and Bert Searcy would say, okay, I think do you need a break?
Oh, yeah.
Breaks
on
the interviews.
They
would have let's turn the camera off for a minute and give you a break. And the camera would be off, 44, 45 minutes. And then when it would come back on, all of a sudden they were remembering everything and they were, it was no longer a light colored house. It was a brick building.
Well, I mean, I guess, Katie, the threat being, I mean, we can only assume what the threat was, but we all know that they signed plea deals to lesser charges than murder one. So they admitted to being in the room when a murder was committed. Maybe it's second degree murder, whatever it is, but it's a plea deal. So they get 10-year sentences and they can get out in 5 with good behavior. And these low intelligence individuals, they're like, hey, I guess 5 years is better than being burned in the electric chair, because that's what they're being threatened with, right? If they don't cop up to being at this thing.
Yeah.
If you go to trial, you're going to lose and you're going to the chair. So sign this document. Go to jail for 10 years, you're out in 5 with good behavior, and we'll keep going until we get somebody with type B blood.
Simplified version, but yes.
Right? I finally understand this case.
Well, Price asks Gonzalez if she ever had memory problems, and she said, no, I mean, maybe like in school, I couldn't really remember school lessons well, but besides that, no. And she's arrested anyway, and it turns out she does have type B blood.
Is she a secretor, or is she a non-secretor, Katie?
She is a secretor.
And they keep her.
And they keep her anyway.
So the same
reason they let Bruce Smith go.
Bruce Smith, if you'll remember, in March of 1985 was let go for this very reason, as was 61 other people that they found.
But we have 5 people who don't even have the type B blood and 1 person with the type B blood but is a secretor, exactly as Bruce Allen Smith was, and we have 6 people arrested.
Well, the first time this happened, when all those 62 people got rightfully let go, that was the Beatrice Police Department.
Yes.
And then in this case, when we kept somebody, despite the fact that their five cohorts, none of them had the right blood, you still had the wrong blood, technically. But now Bert Searcy has, he's...
And this is the sheriff's department.
This is the Gage County Sheriff's Department.
And it's also based on interviews that Bert Searcy began with Lisa Podendorf. We mentioned her last mm-hmm. week. Lisa Podendorf was the 17-year-old informant who says she had this meeting with Joanne Taylor.
Yeah. She told that story within months of the crime taking place to Bert Searcy, but it's when he was a hog farmer
yes.
and was not involved in law enforcement.
Correct. And he was looking into this case.
On his own.
On his own.
Because he was a
claiming to be a private investigator, although the books that I read and the documentaries that I watched could never verify that he had that type of licensure.
I agree. But I mean, Katie, I mean, a former police officer in a small town, friend of the family, I can see where he would feel like he had something to offer to this family. And to this day, when you interview that Keith Morrison video that we watched, they interview Helen Wilson's grandson, Shane Wilson. And he says, look, I can't tell you that Bert Searcy arrested the right people, but I can tell you that he 1000% believes that he arrested the right people.
He does.
Maybe his intelligence level is not much higher than the people he arrested.
Which is a further testament to the fact that he really never should have been in law enforcement.
Agreed.
I'm sorry.
I agree.
I just come out and say that about someone, but this is appalling.
Katie's, egregious, yeah.
Katie's keeping her lips sealed on whether or not that was... Well, no, she did just say egregious as I
it
was
is very much so.
I agree.
Very
I think
much
it was
so.
Ridiculous that this happened.
Well, we've got six people arrested, so we've got six different cases here. Kathy Gonzalez and Thomas Winslow plead no contest to their charges, and so they are sentenced and they are booked and they are in prison. We've got Joanne Taylor, James Dean, and Debbie Sheldon. They all plead guilty to their charges, and they're sentenced and they're booked and they're in prison. And then we've got Joseph White, who pleads not guilty. Remember, he is begging for the DNA test. The court is turning him down, not allowing him to have a DNA test. And so he is convicted by a jury of his peers.
And some of these witnesses testifying,
yes,
these quote witnesses testifying in his trial.
That's true.
To these confessions that they've made.
Dean did and Taylor did, I know for a fact, right?
Yes.
At least two of them did.
Yes. And so the family hears all of this and they hear these things, these horrible things, and they're ready to just fry Joseph White. Mm-hmm. Joseph White also he testifies on his own behalf.
Yeah.
And doesn't really do a very good job because the prosecutor shows him a photo of Helen Wilson. Helen Wilson, if you think about the town that you live in, Helen Wilson was the beloved, older, grandmotherly lady in that town.
Mm-hmm.
People loved her very much so. And no one had anything bad to say about Helen Wilson. And then the way that she died was so unbelievably horrible. And they show her photo to Joseph White and they say, do you know, who is this? And he just says, it's an old lady.
Mm-hmm.
And people in the courtroom said you could just hear the air leave the courtroom when he said that. But to him, Helen Wilson, he didn't know her. That was a picture of an old lady.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have let him testify.
Oh, that was horrible because the jury was done at that point.
Well, I understand, Katie, I totally understand what you're saying, but think about it. If you're wrongly convicted, you're sitting in jail, you're about to go potentially to the electric chair, and it would be hard. Somebody would have to spend a lot of time talking me out of trying, at least, to go up on the witness stand and get myself out of this, but
right.
Here's why you don't, mm-hmm. right? Here's exactly why
right.
you don't.
And let me be clear, that was an uncomfortable laugh. I just did. I'm not laughing. This is a very uncomfortable situation. But the jury, I could not imagine in this town if you take a beloved older lady and her to be raped and murdered and then have someone on the stand who in the court of public opinion has already been convicted to look at her picture and go, an old lady.
Yeah.
And just kind of dismiss her that way. So it was very bad.
A lack of preparation on the defense attorney's behalf, I would say. I mean, surely to God, somebody knew. At some point, they're going to show you a picture of her, and you say, that's a sweet-looking old lady, but I never met her.
I don't know if they knew.
I've never seen that woman in my life.
I don't know if they knew if the prosecution was going to do that. I don't know. But
that makes them a bad attorney if they didn't.
Yeah, and it, really, he shouldn't have been, like Katie said.
And yeah, Katie's right to start with. He should have never been on the witness stand.
Okay, sorry, Katie. Go ahead.
Well, it wasn't until 2007, they're all sitting in prison, that Joseph White successfully petitioned the Nebraska Supreme Court to allow the DNA testing to be done in this case.
Now, let's go back before you reveal this. Mm-hmm. I think everybody probably knows what's going to be revealed by this point. But let me say this. People are believing that in that tiny little apartment of Helen Wilson's, six people plus Helen were up in that apartment all at one time. And the only thing we have to show for it are one blood type from one of the people, no fingerprints from any of the people. Mm-hmm. How does that happen? How does six people go into, well, I can tell you, we're sitting in Katie's office right now, and there's three of us, and we have plenty of room, and my fingerprints are probably all over the place.
Oh God, yeah, are you kidding?
I mean, you're not going to be able to say, well, we can't find any evidence.
Yeah, she was
Kelly
rifling through
there.
The drawers a minute ago, Katie. You might want to check.
True, I was going through all of your personal belongings.
Yeah, so yeah, totally.
But, I mean,
fingerprints everywhere.
I'm just saying that's hard to believe.
Oh yeah.
And hard to buy.
Mm-hmm. But it was bought.
But it was bought, and
yeah,
it was sold.
Yeah, we suspended disbelief on this case a long time ago.
Yeah.
In 2008, the court-ordered DNA testing revealed that none of the six people convicted of the 1985 rape and murder of Helen Wilson in Beatrice, Nebraska, matched the blood or semen recovered from the victim's apartment.
And that was, and Katie mentioned earlier where Wyatt had lobbied to try and get DNA testing done years before. DNA testing, for those of you who don't know, was just, it was a brand new thing in the mid-1980s, and they still hadn't figured out how to do it, and it wasn't nearly as technologically advanced as it was by 2008.
Right. The prosecutor at the center of the Beatrice Six wrongful conviction case, who declined to run DNA test on the crime scene evidence, he later testified in a wrongful conviction suit, and he said, for one, it would be expensive to do. It wasn't cheap at the time. That they didn't think that the test results would even be admitted by a judge in 1989 because it was so new. And there are arguments back and forth on that, because DNA was used to obtain a murder conviction the previous year in New York.
Ah, okay.
So in 1988, DNA was used in New York for a murder conviction. But the forensic tool did not gain full acceptance by the Nebraska Supreme Court until 1997.
Mm-hmm.
DNA was first used in the United States in 1987 to obtain a rape conviction in Florida. But like I said, not till 97 was it admitted in Nebraska. So that is a full 10 years after the first time it was ever used in a case that Nebraska recognized DNA results as valid scientific evidence.
I would say that sounds ass backwards, but I shudder to think when Alabama made that same decision. So maybe we'll find that out in some future podcast episode.
Well, and I want you to remember that he talked about how expensive that test would be.
How much does it cost you to keep somebody wrongfully incarcerated for 20 years?
Okay, just keep that in mind.
Yeah, right. Keep
that in mind.
Oh, yeah, good point. I know where you're going with that.
His name was Richard Smith. He was the Gage County attorney. And he was questioned about this, like I said, in a wrongful conviction suit later on. And he had written to a lab at the time and received like a packet of information back from this lab. And the letters from the lab, it was a lab operating in Maryland, a DNA lab called Cellmark Diagnostics. And the letter said that they could test DNA from minute amounts of evidence, mixed stains, or multiple sources. The letter enclosed an information packet about their services. The testing would have cost $350 per sample.
Just remember that, please.
Yeah.
And they asked if, since the samples at the time would have been 4 years old, would it have mattered? And it said that they had successfully done tests on, their lab had successfully done tests on 9-year-old samples, and the tests had been reliable.
So Gage County voters, when you go to the polls in November, if Richard Smith is still the DA on the ballot, think about that when you think about how much money he cost your county, ultimately.
Well, and he literally testified that he didn't read the lab packet that they sent back with their letter.
He did not read the lab packet. Wow.
I would have preferred an I do not recall response to, nope, I'm an idiot, I threw it in the garbage.
He said he could not recall whether he shared a copy of the letter that they sent with the packet with the defendant's court-appointed attorneys back then. He said he knew he read the letter, but he couldn't remember if he shared it with the court-appointed attorneys for
I'm going to say probably not.
Yeah, so no discovery on that, right? Yeah.
Yes, but...
Well, but damn it, isn't it the damn defense attorney's job to also have called that same lab a month before the DA thought of it and try to get his client off?
Well, no, they...
Out of prison?
No, they motioned to have the DNA test done.
Okay, I got you.
Joseph White's attorneys had filed a motion to have DNA testing done, and it was denied.
I mean, maybe this is a dumb question. We may cut this. Why could Joseph White not send his own blood off to the lab and have it independently tested?
He
I mean, I guess not, right?
To the
well,
court.
You got
he didn't have
first
access.
You got to have access, but then secondly, would a judge even allow it? Would they?
Well,
even,
I guess that's the thing.
You know?
Yeah. Okay.
And so, before I get into the civil lawsuit, they had a psychologist named Eli Chosen evaluate the group after all this happened, and he stated that they were all suffering from Stockholm syndrome. While in prison, a number of the group would still cry to their families and friends about their regret and remorse for and shame of the crimes that they supposedly committed.
So they still believe they had done it at
because
the time.
Because they were swindled into believing that they did this. Because of their dreams.
They became convinced that their dreams reflected
their
own reality.
They were manipulated.
Yeah.
And they truly believed they had done something wrong and felt the remorse about it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get into the civil suit before we get into where that DNA also led us.
Okay.
But so in 2009, Joseph White files a civil suit, and like I've mentioned, some of that testimony was brought up from the former prosecutor, and he is awarded a $28.1 million settlement. The amount of that award was based on the reckless nature of the investigation, as well as, like, you know, the time all six of them had spent in prison.
Right. Well, a lot of them had completed their time.
Yeah.
I mean, Joseph White had not completed his time. But some of the ones who took plea deals...
This is 20 years later.
Were already out. Mm-hmm. They completed the time.
Yeah.
And this did exonerate them, you know, kind of clears their record, but it doesn't give them back that time.
No. And let me just ask for the math experts in the room.
Not me.
$28.1 million is considerably more expensive than the $350 for the DNA.
Yeah. Yeah,
I just wanted to be sure.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, and I don't mean this about anybody that we know here in the local community. We've got a great bunch of law enforcement officials and prosecutors and whatnot. But at some point, don't you just want justice? Didn't you swear an oath to the Constitution to uphold justice? If you know that you've got somebody in jail who didn't do it, shouldn't you want to get them out as fast as you can? Because there's a murderer on the loose.
Exactly. I mean, you don't want any more beloved older ladies raped and murdered on your watch.
Yeah, and I'm probably going to get in trouble for dropping an F-bomb in the middle of the word Constitution, but we'll deal with that when we get
there. Who's going to get on to you for that?
I don't know.
So the county has to pay this $28.1 million debt.
Yes, and
that
is
owed. And the county had to raise taxes in order to do it. So the taxpayers...
The taxpayers are the real sufferers.
Correct, because...
Well, isn't that always the case?
Because Bert Searcy was an employee in the county. It did none of that civil.
He was indemnified by the county, so he didn't know a thing.
Absolutely.
Nor did Dr. Dr. Wayne Price.
No, so neither one of them had to foot any of this bill. And guess what? They're both now retired, and I'm sure the county's paying their pension.
Drawing a pension.
Right now.
Katie,
there you go.
I was going to say, that award was three times the Gage County annual budget.
Yeah, so the taxpayers are paying for all this, as well as the retired investigators and officer, doctor, whatever,
right,
for their pension.
Yep.
How about that?
Yeah.
So you're probably wondering who actually committed this crime.
Thank you, Katie. Who did this? Somebody tell me, who is the perpetrator? Who is the horrible singular individual who did this to this wonderful, sweet lady?
Well, while this test exonerated Joseph White and five of his co-defendants, it did lead us to Bruce Allen Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Allen Smith.
Somebody, I guess, finally figured out that maybe we could send off this blood sample that he gave us in 1988 or 89 and see if this DNA works for him too.
1985, 1 month later.
Okay, it was a month later.
March.
Okay.
And you may think, well, he was ruled out. But it turns out that Miss Joyce Gilchrist, who was a forensic chemist out of Oklahoma. I know that's a little confusing. Where our crime's in Nebraska, but they're getting a forensic chemist out of Oklahoma to test these samples. She has entered his information wrong in the system. And not only...
So that was back in 85. She did this.
He was type B. He was a non-secretor, and she puts him in as type B as a secretor.
So that one little mistake 20 years ago caused six people's lives to go upside down, topsy-turvy, and a rapist and murderer walked away.
Well, and...
At the time.
Yeah, and Gilchrist, I mean, this is not the only time she's been involved in something like this. She participated in more than 3,000 criminal cases in her 21 years working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. And she was accused of falsifying evidence to help prosecutors. Her evidence led in part to like 23 people being sentenced to death, 12 of whom have been executed. And
yikes.
You know,
that's on your hands.
Yep.
That blood is on your hands, ma'am.
And the reason that they sent that to Oklahoma, we talked about this off the air. Bruce Allen Smith had moved from Beatrice, Nebraska to Oklahoma. So when they tracked him down, I guess jurisdictional laws or rules apply. So the folks from Nebraska who were concerned about this Bruce Allen Smith didn't bring his blood sample back with them. They had to send it to the Oklahoma lab, I assume. And that's why the Oklahoma lab gets involved and everybody just takes her word for it for 20 years until what Katie just told us.
Mm-hmm. And like, she's just fired. Like, she's fired in... She had already been fired before this comes out. She was fired in September of 2001 due to flawed casework analysis and laboratory mismanagement. And, of course, she constantly denies any wrongdoing. And she was never charged with a crime.
Wow. Even though 23 people got sent to death row and 12 of them were killed on death row, and she got it wrong.
And I imagine... A lot of these things that she's being accused of it's one of those things where it's probably hard to prove a lot of that.
Yeah, I guess so, but either in this life or the next.
But yeah.
She'll get it.
She knows what she did wrong.
Yeah, she's
which
either incompetent
she,
or she's a criminal and she knows.
And she knows. And so if she is in fact a criminal, then
yeah.
I mean,
wow, ma'am. How do you sleep at night?
Yeah.
What I do every day for a living, like if I mess up, it causes people problems. And, you know, you mess up a real estate transaction and like they're mad and there's like a lot of work involved fixing that. But it's and so like it's important. Like
it's a horrible feeling when you do that.
We have people who five different people look at, you know, something you're doing. You know, you try to make sure I have a lot of money passing through my hands every day. You try to make sure you take every precaution to get your job right. And her job is a lot more important.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
And it just seems like there was no oversight that there was, I mean, she just was allowed to.
And so by the time they do this and they say, aha, we've got our man. Well, Bruce Allen Smith has been dead for years.
He died in 1992.
So Bruce Allen Smith never saw justice for this. And if you watch the Keith Morrison documentary where he investigates the Beatrice Six, it's called Keith Morrison Investigates, mm-hmm. and then it's the Beatrice Six. Yeah. It shows, I can't remember the lady's name that he had interviewed, but she was the one who got the results back and learned that it, in fact, was Bruce Allen Smith. She was a member of the task force that was designed to investigate this.
Mm-hmm. To try and find the real murderer after everyone else had been let go because of the DNA evidence.
Yes. And so she lays the lab results on top of his grave.
His tombstone.
And takes a photo and says, you left something behind. And she said that was the only way that she knew to
slap the handcuffs on him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So he was never punished or brought to justice for this horrific crime. Now, if you look at Bruce Allen Smith, he fits that FBI profile that we talked about last week to a T.
Yeah.
If you go back and listen to the profile, he had lived in the building before, so he knew the building. He had a grandmotherly figure that he lived with there in that building that he despised. All of the other things, the age, his build, the way people describe him, all of that fits that FBI profile.
In addition to a phrase that I remember the FBI agent saying in that Keith Morrison video, a violent, retaliatory rapist.
Exactly. And the same person who attempted the rapes in 1983, when we talked about that last week.
Same profile.
Same person. The FBI profile said you're dealing with the same person. Yeah. And the timeline fits of when he was in Beatrice in those years. It does fit for Bruce Allen Smith. And so that is, he was our perpetrator, and they had him 1 month later. One month later.
And let him go. And then six people's lives went horribly wrong.
Yeah. They spent a combined like 77 years in prison.
Yeah.
And almost bankrupt the county.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure this county still hasn't paid this debt. Who knows? I mean,
who knows? Joseph White, unfortunately, is no longer with us. When he moved back to Alabama, he lived here for a couple of years and then had an accident where he works and was crushed by some of the machinery there. So in the documentary, you don't ever get to hear from him, but you do hear from his mother and you learn a little bit about him. Who he was. And
she is from Coleman, Alabama. Yes, let me just go ahead and tell you. And if you don't know what I mean yet, you will know when you hear her speak. Bless her heart. What a sweet lady.
Oh, shout out to Coleman, Alabama. We love you.
100% from Coleman, Alabama.
So one of the fascinations about this case is how and why would five people confess to something that they did not do? If you watch, I keep going back to the Keith Morrison documentary. If you watch it, they interview a family member of Helen Wilson's, and the family collectively has not forgiven any of these people with the exception of Joseph White. And the reason being is they understand and can respect the fact that Joseph White always said he was innocent. He never confessed to anything. And they have forgiven him. They cannot bring themselves to forgive the other five people who would bring themselves to confess something so horrible and to go as far as testify in court. And they had to hear some of the horrible things that they are saying that happened to their grandmother.
That mother, it turns out was made up.
That was completely made up.
Right.
And so the family, and I'm not faulting the family. I could not imagine being in their position. They did not receive justice, and shame on Bert Searcy for that.
Yeah.
For playing with these people's emotions. Shame on you. And that's horrible. And this family's gone through something horrible. And my heart goes out to them. So I completely understand that. I understand them questioning that and not being able to forgive that. But like I said, they did say they forgive Joseph White. Mm-hmm. But looking into false confessions, just want to give a few facts. Police-induced false confessions are among the leading causes of wrongful convictions. Since the late 1980s, 6 studies alone have documented approximately 250 interrogation-induced false confessions. In a 1987 study, false confessions were the third leading cause of wrongful conviction. In a 2003 study, they were the single leading cause. Police-induced false confessions appear to occur primarily in the more serious cases, especially homicides and other high-profile felonies. More than 80% of the 125 false confessions documented by Professors Steve Drizin and Richard Leo occurred in homicide cases. False confessions make for the leading cause of wrongful convictions in homicide cases. So people aren't just falsely confessing to stealing, you know, someone's purse. They're confessing to homicide. Yeah.
And I guess I'll just never understand the mentality of somebody who goes into a room and sits down with a police officer when they start asking you questions that make it sound like you did something horrible when you don't say, excuse me, am I under arrest? Can I leave? Either arrest me and let me ask for my lawyer or I'm walking out the door. And maybe it's a little bit more complicated than that. I suppose they can hold you for a certain amount of time.
It is a little more complicated than that. And I think Shane mentioned this at our live show. But
he did. I just remember.
They're trained to, the smartest person could still, it's not immediate.
Be coaxed into saying something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there have been studies that where they know people are innocent mm-hmm. and they bring them in.
Yeah.
And then they interrogate them to see if they will confess.
Have you listened to the episode that we've been doing for the last hour? A perfect example of that very thing. It really is.
But these were research studies set up where people volunteered. Yeah. Going into this thinking they're never going to confess to something and end up confessing. Just a few more statistics that I have here. More than 2/3 of the DNA cleared homicide cases documented by the Innocence Project were caused by false confessions. There have been 317 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the United States.
Which doesn't sound like a lot necessarily, unless you're one of those 317 people who knows mm-hmm. you didn't do it.
Right. The average length of time served by people who were exonerated is 13.5 years. So the wheels of justice grind slowly.
They sure do.
When at all.
92% of false confessors are men. 22% were mentally handicapped.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit of a dated term.
Certainly, yeah.
But that's... Yeah. I'm looking at the statistics here from these 1987 all the way up to 2003 studies, but a very high percentage of them have mental health issues, learning disabilities.
I think we could go back again to the Netflix series about Stephen Avery, that nephew of his, obviously.
Making a Murder.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. If you watch that
Brendan Dassey.
If you watch the video when Brendan is in that room being interrogated for hours on end, and he's obviously mentally challenged.
Without his mother. He's also a minor.
Yeah.
No parent, no lawyer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just damn it, guys. Do your jobs right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
I know.
Sorry.
And thank you to all of the wonderful
people who do.
Of all you wonderful people out there who do it right. And these bad apples, you know, we're not going to allow them to make you all look bad. So
not on our watch.
Nope.
All right. Well, can I do a couple of things at the end of the show before we hang on?
Absolutely.
I think since tonight is the national championship game and nobody's going to hear this until Wednesday, we should all predict the final score of the game. And then when people listen to this on Wednesday, they will know who is right and who is wrong. Unless, I don't know how much of a fans of tonight's game you guys are. It's Alabama versus Georgia for the college football national championship. What do you guys think, Katie?
As a graduate of Auburn University, I can't think of a worse matchup.
I know, right?
Yeah, I was for me. To say it's Lydia. I wouldn't even know where to start to predict it.
So we're gonna
write it down.
Okay, we're gonna predict scores.
Right. Yeah, and it's next week.
Let me think a second.
43-28.
Who?
I don't know. Alabama.
All right. Alabama 43, Georgia 28.
Is 43 even a score you would get?
It's possible, sure.
Lord, right,
and that's Katie. All right. Kelly, what do you think?
Give me a second. Right. Hold on. Go ahead and say yours.
Okay. I think it's going to be something more like, and I was talking with Greg Oliver, a good friend of ours. Shout out to Greg over at Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall earlier. We think it's going to be a game that comes down to a field goal at the end, and Alabama's going to have a chance to either win the game or lose the game on the last second field goal. So I'm going to say 37-34 Georgia.
I'm going to say,
I think Georgia's going to win tonight.
What?
I think it's
I'm going to say 28-21 Alabama.
All right. So we've got two Alabama high scores and one Georgia high score. Mm-hmm. Somebody can email us later on in the week when you hear this at truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com and let us know how smart or dumb we are. And go to our new website, truecrimeoneasystreet.com. And go to our Facebook page. Nobody goes to our Facebook page except the three of us. So go there, Facebook/
and like it.
True crime something.
Follow it.
Yeah,
whatever.
We try to keep you updated there.
Mm-hmm. Follow us on Instagram.
And we'll be here live again on the night. Live at the Easy Street across. We're now literally, we can look out the window and see Easy Street when we are doing the show. Mm-hmm. We'll be there on Wednesday, January the 19th at 7:30 p.m. doing a live show if
exactly.
Katie is... if Kelly is back healthy by then.
We'll thanks, see. Guys. I heard you did a great job without me, so you guys don't need me.
You weren't there? I'm kidding. We missed you horribly. Oh, shout out to my friend Shane Loveless. He gave me a ride. He's a listener of the show. He gave me a ride last week when I had car trouble. So thank you, Shane Loveless. He's a friend of Kevin Green's, a relative.
Okay.
Yeah,
he's
brother-in-law.
Yeah.
Shout out to Dr. Clint Allen, who you did reach out to, and he explained secretor versus non-secretor. So thank you.
Had a conversation on Saturday. Thank you, Doc.
He is an actual doctor and a very good doctor.
He is indeed.
Yes.
Are we done?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, good night, everybody.